Students in university adjudications are similarly frustrated. At 1:05 p.m. on November 18th, less than 2 hours before Smith's university court hearing was scheduled to begin, Van de Wettering sent an email to Dean Couture asking to postpone the hearing until December 2nd in order to have more time to obtain police reports about the case. Smith had by this time learned that 3 days earlier, Chief Deputy County Attorney Kirsten Pabst declined to prosecute the case. Van de Wettering believed that this information should be considered by the university court before it arrived at a verdict, and he informed Couture that he intended to call Pabst as a witness for Smith at the hearing. Van de Wettering said he hoped to call Detective Bruckner as a witness as well. Couture immediately sent Van de Wettering an email denying his request. "Josh, I am perplexed as to why you waited until less than 2 hours until the hearing to request an extension. I was informed yesterday that Police Chief Muir had denied your request for the female detective to participate. Based on statements in your email, I think you need to be reminded that you shall not call any witnesses at the university court hearing. Your client shall call his own witnesses and present his own case. Your participation shall be strictly limited to private consultation with your client. Your client's appeal shall begin today at 3 p.m. After I have presented the university's case against your client may request the court chair to continue the hearing on December 2nd. This is an educational proceeding, not a criminal one." Van de Wettering fired back, "I am not seeking to stall the case. I'm merely trying to ensure my client has a quality defense against extremely serious accusations that, if confirmed, will impact the rest of his life. That effort is complicated and its importance underscored by the fact that you have concluded a rape did occur, while trained investigators and prosecutors have concluded it did not, a fact I cannot leave unconsidered. I understand what my role is, and while I find it oppressive to think that you, with your education and experience, will be presenting the university's case while forcing an 18-year-old kid to try to stand up against you by himself, I will abide by the rules. We will be there at 3 o'clock, and I will ask the chair for additional time. And please rest assured, the entire proceeding has indeed been an education." The 7 individuals on the university court are appointed by the president of the University of Montana. The court is composed of 3 undergraduate students, 1 graduate student, 2 faculty members, and 1 staff member. At Calvin Smith's hearing on November 18, 2011, held in the basement of Main Hall, the chair of the court was a distinguished professor from the university's School of Business Administration. She served as the academic equivalent of a judge and ran the proceeding. Dean Charles Couture, representing the university's interests, acted as the equivalent of a prosecutor, calling witnesses and presenting evidence against Smith. The first person Couture called to testify was Caitlin Kelly, who answered questions posed by Couture and the members of the court for 17 minutes, providing an abbreviated version of the same information she had previously conveyed in her one-on-one interviews with Couture and Detective Connie Bruckner. The court then received testimony from 6 witnesses who had been summoned by Couture on behalf of Kelly. Carrie Barrett, Kelly's roommate, the roommate's boyfriend, the coordinator of the university's Student Advocacy Resource Center, and Kelly's parents. 90 minutes into the proceeding, it was Calvin Smith's turn to present the witnesses he'd asked to testify on his behalf. The first witness to appear was Prosecutor Kirsten Pabst, supervisor of the Sexual Assault Division at the Missoula County Attorney's Office. Pabst was 44 years old and had a commanding presence. She'd been raised by working-class parents in Havre, Montana, a windswept railroad town on the Great Northern High Line, 30 miles from the Canadian border. During her childhood, she told Missoulian reporter Catherine Hake, "When times got lean, her family sometimes lived in a converted garage without running water." In 1985, she enrolled at the University of Montana. She became a fine arts major, but she dropped out before graduating and moved to Great Falls. A single mother at the time, she was working at a restaurant when she decided to return to school to become a paralegal. She eventually got a law degree at UM, and in 1995, a week after having her second child, she went to work as a prosecutor for Cascade County. 2 years later, she landed a job as a deputy Missoula County attorney, and she had been employed as a prosecutor there ever since. In 2006, Pabst was promoted to Chief Deputy Missoula County Attorney, with responsibility for supervising the prosecution of sexual assault cases. By 2011, when she appeared at Calvin Smith's university court hearing, Pabst had been married twice, given birth to 4 children, the youngest of whom was still a toddler, and was an expert horsewoman and an accomplished artist. With her brash demeanor and shoulder-length blonde hair, she cut a distinctive profile around town. I was completely astounded when I realized Kirsten Pabst was appearing as a witness for Calvin, says Carrie Barrett, recalling her reaction when Pabst showed up for Smith's hearing. She was in charge of the criminal case against Kelly's rapist, and here she was at university court defending him. Barrett's surprise grew when she observed Pabst interacting warmly with Smith and his parents as if they were old friends. Like Carrie Barrett, Dean Couture disapproved of the county prosecutor's advocacy on Calvin Smith's behalf. After the hearing, Couture told Kelly that Pabst's presence was totally out of place and not appropriate. Couture frowned on Pabst's involvement in the university's adjudication of Smith's case for several reasons, not least of them being that the university was required to use a very different burden of proof in determining Smith's innocence or guilt than Pabst had used when she declined to file criminal charges against him. 7 months earlier, in April 2011, the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights had sent a letter to colleges and universities nationwide. It became known as the Dear Colleague Letter. In no uncertain terms, it reminded universities of their obligation to protect students from sexual harassment and sexual violence under Title IX. To make it harder for students to rape with impunity, the Dear Colleague Letter decreed that schools must use a burden of proof known as the preponderance of evidence standard when adjudicating sexual assault complaints. To find a student guilty, in other words, a school needed only to determine that, after a review of credible evidence, it was more likely than not that the accused individual had committed the offense. More than once during the Calvin Smith hearing, Dean Couture reminded the university court that this is a much lower burden of proof than Pabst or any other prosecutor was obligated to use in a criminal trial, the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Kirsten Pabst testified before the university court in support of Smith for 42 minutes, more than twice as long as any other witness, including Caitlin Kelly. Pabst used the opportunity to explain her rationale for declining to prosecute Smith, and therefore why, in her opinion, it would be a mistake for the university court to find him guilty of rape. Pabst emphasized that when she'd discussed the case with Detective Connie Bruckner, Bruckner had told her there wasn't even probable cause to file criminal charges against Smith. According to Pabst, she then conducted an independent review of the evidence Bruckner had gathered, and we both came to the same conclusion, that it wasn't prosecutable. Pabst explained that in Montana, prosecutors of sex crimes are required not only to prove that the victim didn't consent, but to prove that the defendant reasonably knew that she didn't consent. We get a lot of alcohol and drug-related cases where there is sexual contact, date rape-type cases, Pabst continued. And they are really, really hard cases for us. But this one was different. This one was a little bit more clean-cut in that, according to all of the witnesses, Mr. Smith and the alleged victim agreed to have sex. Her friends and his friends both were trying to get them, pardon me for sounding crude, were trying to get them laid. And the victim, in fact, told the detective that that was her plan, to go back to her room and have sex. So we don't have the whole really blurry consent issue that we normally do. However, when questioned by a member of the court, Pabst conceded, "Of course somebody can withdraw consent, but it's unusual to have such a really clear picture of consent going into it, and all of the witnesses are in agreement on that, so that was a really big factor." The other thing was that everyone agreed that Mr. Smith did not finish the sex act, and that he stopped at some point. Here it gets a little bit more blurry, but he was requested to stop at some point where it became uncomfortable for her, and he did. A few minutes later, Pabst added, "Once there was an affirmative verbal agreement to have sex, so consent was given, she's really fuzzy on whether or not she verbally withdrew that consent. So it's not fair for us as prosecutors to expect a suspect to read someone's mind when they've verbally given consent." Although Kirsten Pabst took considerable time from her busy schedule to appear before the university court on behalf of Calvin Smith, she never bothered to speak to Caitlin Kelly, in violation of a Montana law that requires prosecutors to consult with rape victims. MCA 46-24-104, Consultation with Victim of Certain Offenses. As soon as possible prior to disposition of the case, the prosecuting attorney in a criminal case shall consult with the victim of a felony offense or a misdemeanor offense involving actual, threatened, or potential bodily injury to the victim, including, number 1, dismissal of the case, number 2, release of the accused pending judicial proceedings, number 3, plea negotiations, and number 4, pre-trial diversion of the case from the judicial process. Nor, apparently, did Pabst take the time to listen to the recording of Detective Bruckner's interview with Kelly, because a number of Pabst's assertions about what Kelly did or didn't say to Bruckner are just plain wrong. For example, when Pabst testified that Smith was requested to stop at some point where it became uncomfortable for her, and he did, Pabst failed to mention that the only reason Smith finally stopped, according to Kelly's testimony, was that she managed to shove him away and flee from the room, after telling him numerous times to cease penetrating her with his fingers and forcing his penis into her mouth. In her testimony to both Detective Bruckner and Dean Couture, Caitlin Kelly was the opposite of fuzzy on whether or not she verbally withdrew consent. Kelly adamantly and consistently stated that she said no and stop many times while Smith was penetrating her. Kelly also clearly asserted that she verbally withdrew her consent to have sex when she initially entered her dorm room and saw that her roommate and her roommate's boyfriend were present. When Calvin Smith said, "It's okay, we'll be quiet," in reply to her initial withdrawal of consent, Kelly can't recall if she reiterated that she wouldn't engage in sex while other people were in the room. But she is certain that she didn't say anything that could have been interpreted as an affirmation of consent after she withdrew it upon entering the room. And the University of Montana's policy concerning rape and other sexual misconduct clearly states that consent cannot be inferred from silence, past consent, or consent to a different form of sexual activity. Caitlin Kelly told both Detective Bruckner and Dean Couture that while she was unconscious and therefore incapable of granting consent, Smith removed her pants and underwear and penetrated her vagina with his fingers. This prompted a member of the court to ask Pabst, "You can't give consent when you're asleep, so even if you'd given it previously, that doesn't count if you're asleep, right?" "Correct," Pabst replied. A moment later, however, she hedged. "Well, it depends. That's not really a hard and fast rule. But some people would argue that if I go home with someone and we say, well, we're going to go have sex, and then I fall asleep and wake up and he's having sex with me, some people would say that's consensual, and some people would say it's not." The questioner followed up, "What does the law say?" "I don't know the answer to that," Pabst answered. "There is no hard and fast rule." A different member of the court asked Pabst to confirm that to withdraw consent, all you have to do is say no or stop one time, and you have withdrawn consent. "Usually that is the case," Pabst confirmed. "If the defendant's in hearing and understanding of that, and he hears someone say no, no means no. There's no question about that if that is conveyed." But Kirsten Pabst refused to concede that Caitlin Kelly had clearly said no, or that she had been too inebriated to understand what she'd agreed to do. "There just aren't that many facts in dispute here," Pabst told the court. Before Kelly entered her residence hall with Calvin Smith, Kelly told the friend she was with, Greg Witt, that she thought Smith was cute, and she agreed to have sex with him. And Pabst didn't think Kelly was too drunk to give consent at the time. Dean Charles Couture accused Pabst of jumping to conclusions. Just because Kelly said Smith was cute, Couture wondered, and they agreed to go back and have voluntary sex, are you assuming that they went and had voluntary sex? Pabst, he argued, seemed to be ignoring the fact that Kelly withdrew her consent as soon as she and Smith entered her room. Pabst replied that nothing in the case report she'd received from Detective Bruckner confirmed that Caitlin Kelly ever clearly said no. "I have not jumped to any conclusion," Pabst insisted. Early in her testimony, Kirsten Pabst told the university court, "There is no better predictor of future behavior than past behavior. With Mr. Smith's case, he has absolutely no criminal history at all. There is not even a traffic ticket that we could find on the record." All of Smith's acquaintances, Pabst said, had described him as a stellar citizen who had never been in trouble. Calvin Smith was happy-go-lucky, kind, compassionate. Those are things that we have to take into account when we're deciding whether or not this is a case we are going to charge. At another point, Papps said she found it significant that when Detective Bruckner interviewed Smith at the police station and told him that Caitlin Kelly had accused him of raping her, Smith became distraught and tearful and extremely sorry that she was upset. He said that he had never meant to hurt her or make her sad. He seemed genuine in his emotions and was really surprised by the accusation. As Caitlin Kelly listened to Papps tell the court that Calvin Smith was too kind and compassionate to be a rapist, she was dumbfounded. Kirsten Papps refused to even talk to me when I was trying to find out why nothing was being done about my case, Kelly recalled bitterly. And then she goes out of her way to show up at university court to testify for the asshole who raped me? I couldn't believe it. On the advice of his lawyer, Josh Van de Wettering, during the hearing, Calvin Smith declined to testify or answer questions from court members. In lieu of giving a statement to the court, Smith asked Papps to describe the brief statement he gave to Detective Bruckner on October 11th, then tell the court what she thought about it. Papps responded, "Everyone absolutely has the right to remain silent, but it's impressive to me when people are willing to come forward and tell what happened, openly and honestly, which is what Mr. Smith did with Detective Bruckner. He came in voluntarily and answered all of her questions. According to Detective Bruckner, he sincerely stated that he really thought that Caitlin Kelly was enjoying what was going on, at least at the beginning, until he realized that wasn't the case. Papps told the court that before Calvin Smith penetrated Kelly with his fingers or penis, he said that they made out. There was some kissing involved. Much of what he said mirrored what the victim said about a brief period of oral sex, all of which Papps saw as evidence that the sex was consensual. Kirsten Papps didn't consider the possibility that Smith's presumption of entitlement, amplified by his drunkenness, led him to disregard Caitlin Kelly's commands to stop. When they entered Kelly's dorm room and saw two other people asleep, instead of accepting her pronouncement that having sex was no longer possible, Smith dismissed the change in plans by saying, "We'll be quiet." A few minutes earlier, she'd invited him to knock boots, and he wasn't going to let her withdraw the offer now, when he was on the verge of finally shedding his virginity. A deal was a deal. She'd said yes once, and that was all the consent he thought he needed. Once Kelly was unconscious, Smith pulled off her pants and underwear and started jamming his fingers into her vagina. When the intense pain woke her up and she begged him to stop, he countered, "No, just wait," and then grabbed the back of her head and thrust his erect penis into her mouth. Most women are all too familiar with men like Calvin Smith, men whose sense of prerogative renders them deaf when women say, "No thanks, not interested," or even, "Fuck off, creep." Smith forced Caitlin Kelly to perform fellatio. Kirsten Papps referred to this as a brief period of oral sex, and asserted that Smith genuinely believed Kelly was enjoying what was going on. But if Papps had taken the time to listen to the recording of Detective Bruckner questioning Kelly, she would have heard a very different description. Kelly told Bruckner that after Smith finished stabbing his fingers painfully into her vagina, and before he started stabbing his fingers painfully into her anus, he decided that he needed oral sex, so he kept pushing my head down, like my throat hurt the next day. I was gagging a lot. I'm surprised my roommate didn't wake up from me doing that, because it was not pleasant. He pulled me over on top of him and just kind of, like, unzipped and pulled it out, and then started shoving my head down. I couldn't breathe. I was spinning everywhere. He was gagging me really bad. Calvin Smith's claim that he believed Caitlin Kelly enjoyed the sexual acts he inflicted on her is revealing. A callow 18-year-old, he'd testified earlier that what happened with Caitlin is the farthest I've ever really gone with a woman. By Smith's own admission, his understanding of female sexuality was derived primarily from internet pornography. Hence his explanation to Dean Couture in October that he wanted to make Kelly squirt. The porn Smith viewed led him to believe that vaginal squirting was the supreme female expression of sexual pleasure, and that frenetically jabbing his fingers into her vagina and anus would elicit such a response. A rapist, by definition, is only interested in gratifying his own desires. A rapist doesn't care what a woman wants. If he did, he wouldn't rape. When a member of the university court asked Kirsten Papps whether she thought Calvin Smith's theft of Caitlin Kelly's jeans was indicative of anything, Papps dismissed its importance. It kind of reminded me she said, of a teenage boy thing. Pabst, however, thought that minor inconsistencies in Kelly's testimony were quite important. There were several points where Kelly's account of what happened, the chronology, changed, which was pretty significant, Pabst told the court. Because at one point she said that she woke up to him digitally penetrating her, and it was really painful. But then later she said he forced her to perform fellatio on him, and that happened first. So she already would have been awake at the point when she said he forced her to perform fellatio, even though previously she said this whole thing started with her waking up to his fingers in her vagina. Pabst insisted that Kelly's conflicting accounts of when Smith thrust his penis into her mouth raised questions for her as a prosecutor. 1. Am I ever going to be able to convince a jury that this crime happened beyond a reasonable doubt? And 2. Have I reached my threshold of probable cause? We have to take into account those inconsistencies of the victim's allegation. When she was a young single mother and college dropout struggling to pay the bills, Kirsten Pabst pulled herself up by her own bootstraps. Later, she was a victim of domestic violence. Years after that, in 2008, she came home from work one afternoon to discover the lifeless body of her 13-year-old son, who'd perished in a horrible accident. Emotional trauma was not an abstract concept to Pabst. She'd experienced it firsthand. In her opinion, nevertheless, what happened to Caitlin Kelly was no big deal, and it certainly wasn't rape. It was merely a consensual hookup that had failed to live up to Kelly's expectations. Kelly needed to get over it and move on with her life. I have not met Caitlin Kelly, Pabst admitted. I have not talked to her. I've talked to a lot of victims, though, and I work with victims, and people consider me a staunch victim's advocate, so I have no doubt that she feels traumatized by these events. But Pabst believed that Kelly's anguish happened more after the fact, when, the following morning, hungover, she looked back on the maladroit sex and realized the encounter didn't pan out the way that really either of them had planned. Pabst is simply wrong about this, and about many other details of the encounter between Caitlin Kelly and Calvin Smith. Because she refused to talk to Kelly, Pabst's conclusions were based on bad information, and her testimony about the inconsistencies in Kelly's testimony was incorrect. Kelly never told Bruckner or Couture or anyone else that the fellatio happened first. Kelly unwaveringly asserted that she woke up when she felt Smith violently stabbing his fingers into her vagina. The only inconsistent aspect of Kelly's testimony concerned the chronology of what happened after she was awakened by Smith's digital penetration. Initially, she told Officer Krastel that Smith first violated her by inserting his fingers into her vagina and then stabbed them into her anus and then forced her to perform fellatio. Later, when interviewed by Detective Bruckner, Kelly said that although she was indeed first awakened by Smith stabbing his fingers into her vagina, next he pulled her down to his crotch and forced her to perform fellatio, after which he stabbed his fingers into her anus. According to David Lisak, Russell Strand, and other experts who have served as investigators or consultants in rape cases, such inconsistencies in the accounts provided by victims of sexual assaults are quite common and can easily be explained by the way trauma affects memory, a phenomenon documented in numerous empirical studies published in peer-reviewed journals. As psychiatrist Judith Lewis explains in her book Trauma and Recovery, traumatic memories have a number of unusual qualities. They are not encoded like the ordinary memories of adults in a verbal, linear narrative that is assimilated into an ongoing life story. Rather, they are encoded in the form of vivid sensations and images. It is therefore not surprising that Caitlin Kelly's memory of being violated by Calvin Smith was impressionistic rather than perfectly linear. Despite the minor chronological inconsistencies in Kelly's statements, moreover, Smith's own statements corroborated Kelly's claims that each of the sex acts she described actually occurred. Pabst's assertion that slight contradictions in Kelly's testimony were a significant factor in her decision not to prosecute Smith thus raises disturbing questions about Pabst's credibility, not only in relation to her participation in the university court hearing, but also concerning her peremptory dismissal of Missoula County's criminal case against Smith. When Kirsten Pabst concluded her testimony, Calvin Smith called his next witness, Ralph Richards, who told the university court that he and Smith had gone to the same high school and had been close friends since 10th grade. Richards was in Smith's dormitory room, visiting Smith's roommate, when Smith returned from his encounter with Caitlin Kelly. When Calvin came home, Richards acknowledged, he was carrying a pair of jeans. He said he didn't know why he had them, and we just kind of dropped it. Then, in the university courtroom, out of the blue, Richards lets out a weird, involuntary guffaw. Although he quickly suppressed his laughter, there was no mistaking that the theft of Kelly's pants struck Richards as hilarious. Continuing his testimony, Ralph Richards said that after Calvin Smith came into the room carrying the jeans, the two of them went out for a walk, and Smith told him that he had fingered Caitlin Kelly and that she gave him oral sex for a minute. Recalling this conversation caused Richards to cackle with laughter again, as if he were playing Beavis to Smith's butthead. When he'd regained his composure, Richards told the court, "I didn't think anything of it. That's all he kind of told me." Ralph Richards was excused, and Calvin Smith's father came into the room to testify as a character witness. Calvin asked him, "Can you describe what kind of person I am?" "What I know of you, you've been a very good kid," Smith's dad replied in an emotional voice, his eyes welling with tears. "You never disrespect me, never use God's name in vain. I've been told by your friends that you were just a big teddy bear, and you are a teddy bear. I don't believe you could hurt anybody." The next witness was Smith's mother, Mary. "What did you think when you heard about these allegations?" Calvin asked her. "I thought there was absolutely no way that my son would intentionally hurt anybody ever," she answered. "How much time have you spent around your son when he was intoxicated?" a member of the court asked Mrs. Smith. "I haven't," she answered. After Calvin Smith's parents finished testifying, Calvin asked the university court to continue the hearing at a later date so he could have more time to present his case. "No," the chairwoman pronounced. "The proceedings just allow for a court hearing, and this is your court hearing. Do you have a statement?" Smith declined. "I've given my statement to the police," he explained. "On my lawyer's advice, I plead the Fifth." His lawyer, Josh Van de Wettering, had counseled Smith not to testify at the hearing because if criminal charges were brought against him at a later date, anything he said could potentially be used against him by prosecutors. The court chair urged Smith to make a statement regardless. "This is a confidential proceeding, so I don't think that's relevant." "He has a right to remain silent," Dean Couture pointed out to the chairwoman. "Can we ask him questions?" the chairwoman asked Couture. "You can," Couture replied, "but he would then just say he is not going to answer them." David Aronofsky, the University of Montana's legal counsel, had been silently observing the hearing and was not supposed to address the university court. After pondering Calvin Smith's request to continue the hearing at a later date, however, he spoke up. "I gotta tell you," he said, "I don't care if the court gives me permission or not. As the chief legal officer of this university, I have some concerns about assuming this proceeding has to end today. If there is material evidence..." "David," Charles Couture interrupted, "you are not allowed to participate." "I am participating, Charles," Aronofsky protested. "You are not allowed to participate," Couture said again, raising his voice. "Well, then I'm doing this without authorization," Aronofsky declared. "You certainly are," Couture said sternly. "And let the record note that I'm speaking without the authorization of the court," Aronofsky continued. "But part of my responsibility as chief legal officer is to make sure that all of the parties are compliant with the law. And if there is evidence that this court can receive that could influence the decision that could result in the remedy of expulsion, in my opinion, there is an obligation by the university for this court to consider it. And I object that the chair is not shutting down David," Dean Couture told the court. "He has no right to participate." The issue arose because Missoula County Prosecutor Kirsten Pabst's testimony at the hearing was based on statements and evidence obtained by the Missoula Police Department, but the police had not released any of those statements or any of that evidence to Caitlin Kelly or Calvin Smith, despite requests from both of them. Smith and Josh Van de Wettering thought some of this evidence might turn out to be exculpatory, and they wanted a chance to present it to the university court before a verdict was rendered. According to University of Montana policy, however, Dean of Students Charles Couture had a duty to investigate the alleged rape of Caitlin Kelly independently. Thus, Neither the criminal investigation by the Montana Police Department nor Kirsten Papp's determination that there was insufficient probable cause to prosecute Calvin Smith should have any bearing on the university's disciplinary proceeding. Calvin Smith had been given multiple opportunities to present his side of the story to Dean Couture and Vice President Teresa Branch, and to call witnesses at the university court hearing. Couture not only believed that he had done a thorough investigation, he'd thought he'd done a better job of gathering and weighing the evidence than the Missoula police or Kirsten Pabst had. In his view, there was no reason to have a second hearing. The chair of the university court agreed. "We are going to proceed," she announced, trying to reestablish order. "We followed the procedures on the timing," she told David Aronofsky, explaining why the hearing would not be continued at a later date. "The timing is tight for a reason. You don't get forever to try this like you do in a legal proceeding. I don't hear any of the court members objecting to finishing tonight." Concerned about whether Calvin Smith had been granted sufficient time to interview witnesses and prepare in advance of the hearing, a court member asked, "Is it true that Smith received notice from Charles Couture on November 2nd that he was being investigated?" "No," Dean Couture said. "He was informed of the alleged misconduct, dated my letter to him, October 20th. "Okay," the court member said. "So it's been almost a month. We've heard everything reasonably, and he's had a month to get all of his ducks in a row, and we're not a court of law. So I'm sorry." "May I explain?" Josh Van de Wettering asked, hoping to enlighten the university court about why Calvin Smith, his client, needed more time to present his case. "No," Couture said, cutting him off. At this point, the chairwoman halted the hearing to hold an executive session. She thought it prudent to clear the room so the court members could pause, take a collective deep breath, and have a brief discussion to ensure that they were doing everything properly. Several minutes later, when the hearing was called back to order, she announced, "First of all, the court would like to remind both legal counsels that you are welcome to confer with your associated parties, but please don't directly address us, as tempting as that might be. The court unanimously agrees with my ruling that we finish this hearing tonight." A few witnesses were called back for further questioning, and then Dean Couture began his closing statement. "Most parents are going to say fine things about their children," he reminded the court, "and want to believe the best about their children. But," he added, "we all know that parents don't know everything that their kids do. That's a given fact. The first day I met with Calvin in my office, he cried most of the time. He said the sex was consensual. He wasn't crying out of the basis of any heartfelt concern for the victim. He was scared. He was absolutely terrified. Watching him cry, I had emotional difficulty dealing with that myself. He was hurting, very much so." At the time of their first meeting, Dean Couture was in the midst of investigating the allegations against Calvin Smith. He hadn't yet received Caitlin Kelly's medical report or interviewed key witnesses. A week or so later, after he'd concluded his investigation and determined that Smith was guilty of rape, Couture summoned Smith to his office again. "When he entered my office the second time," Couture told the court, "his demeanor was entirely different. He was cocky. He didn't really seem to care what I had to say about the additional evidence that I shared with him." Immediately after Dean Couture finished speaking, Calvin Smith presented his closing statement. "The reason I cried in front of the dean is the same reason I cried in front of the police officer," Smith explained. "I felt bad. I never meant to hurt anybody. I was scared. I mean, I was looking at expulsion. I was looking at possible prison time. I've never been in trouble. I never even got sent to the principal's office when I was in high school. I know I made mistakes that day. I definitely drank too much. I stole pants. I went into the girl's bathroom. But I know that she never said no while it was happening, and I know that I didn't rape her. I just find it hard to believe that she said no 7 or 8 times, but as soon as she said, 'I have to pee,' I let her up." Following these words from Smith, the hearing was concluded. 2 weeks later, on December 2nd, 2011, the university court announced its decision in a letter to Dean Couture and President Engstrom. "The court finds that Ms. Kelly removed consent at 3 different points, at least. Upon entering the occupied room, upon going to sleep, and upon stating no or stop during the acts. This is corroborated by the violent nature of the acts, as evidenced by pain, blood, abrasions, and bruising. Thus, Mr. Smith did so violate the Student Conduct Code, Section VA-18, by sexual intercourse without consent, rape. Using the preponderance of evidence standard as required by the Department of Education, unanimous with 7 votes in favor, 0 votes opposed. Given the severity and harm resulting from the sexual assault without consent, rape, and the requirement to protect the complainant, the court imposes the following sanctions, 6 votes in favor, 1 vote opposed. Number 1. Immediate expulsion from the university. Number 2. Prohibit access to university property or university-sponsored activities, effective immediately. The verdict infuriated Calvin Smith and his family, who were absolutely certain that Calvin was innocent, had been falsely accused, and was the victim of both political correctness and a rush to judgment by the University of Montana. But Caitlin Kelly and her family were also unhappy with the verdict. Although Kelly is grateful to Charles Couture and the University of Montana for conducting a disciplinary proceeding that held Smith accountable for raping her, she thinks he got off way too easy. Kelly believes Smith should have been not only expelled, but also incarcerated. She is angry with Kirsten Pabst, Detective Bruckner, the Missoula Police Department, and the Missoula County Attorney's Office for refusing to even charge Smith. Kelly understands that her case might not have been easy to win had it gone to trial, but she is bitterly disappointed to have been denied the opportunity to testify in a court of law about how Smith violated her body and wounded her soul. She believes a jury should have been allowed to decide whether Calvin Smith was guilty of sexual intercourse without consent, rather than letting Kirsten Pabst make that determination unilaterally. Chapter 9. The more Carrie Barrett and Caitlin Kelly thought about the refusal of the Missoula police and prosecutors to file criminal charges against their assailants, the more discouraged they became. Before the university court hearing, when they requested information about their cases from the Missoula police, they were ignored, prompting Carrie's father, Kevin Barrett, to phone Missoula Police Chief Mark Muir on his daughter's behalf. Kevin Barrett is a retired police lieutenant with a doctorate from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, who presently serves as the chairman of the Criminal Justice Department at Rockland Community College in New York. When he called Chief Muir, Kevin recalled, "I let him know right away that I was a cop, and I told him what I expected of him as a fellow cop." Kevin expressed his concern that Muir's officers and detectives appeared to grant less credence to the statements given by Carrie Barrett and Caitlin Kelly than the statements given by the men accused of assaulting them. Kevin asked Chief Muir if he was familiar with an educational video called Duty Trumps Doubt, which is used by thousands of police departments across the country to teach their officers how to properly investigate rape cases. Muir replied that he knew it well, and that the Missoula Police Department showed the video as part of its training. "One of the key messages in the video," Kevin Barrett told me, "is how important it is for you as a cop to always believe the victim until every witness has been interviewed and all the available evidence has been gathered, and only then make a determination as to whether or not she is telling the truth. In most crimes, that's what cops do. But in sexual assault cases, too many cops don't take that approach. So I asked Muir, if you used that video to train your officers, how come one of them asked Carrie if she had a boyfriend? And why did your detective tell her that the defendant cried and talked about how his reputation would be ruined if he was charged? Why do your detectives seem more concerned about the defendant than the victim?" Kevin Barrett criticized both the police and the prosecutors in Missoula for their apparent reluctance to pursue rape cases unless they were absolutely certain they would prevail in court. He pointed out that in the decades before cops and district attorneys had the technological means to use DNA as evidence, every rape case was a matter of he said, she said, but we still prosecuted. Everybody likes to have a high batting average when it comes to winning cases, but sometimes you have to bring the case to court and let it be decided there, instead of deciding beforehand that the odds of winning aren't good enough to go forward. When you have a victim who's willing to go the distance and you shut her down, what does that say to other victims? Don't bother? When cops and prosecutors fail to aggressively pursue sexual assault cases, Kevin argued, it sends a message to sexual predators that women are fair game and can be raped with impunity. On November 15, 2011, after prodding from Kevin Barrett, Muir finally agreed to meet with Carrie Barrett and Caitlin Kelly. During the two-hour discussion they had at the Missoula police station, according to Carrie, Chief Muir said all the right things. He assured us he would give a good ass-chewing to the detectives who investigated our cases. He was very apologetic about what happened and seemed to be listening carefully to our concerns. But he never actually did anything about our concerns. Near the conclusion of their meeting, Carrie brought up what had happened when she first reported her assault to Officer Brian Vreeland. He'd asked her if she had a boyfriend, because he took it for granted that women commonly lied about being raped. Carrie pointed out to Muir that Vreeland's question was offensive for a number of reasons, not least of which being that the rate of false rape claims is in reality quite low, under 10%. "When I mentioned this," says Carrie, "Muir got very defensive and said, 'Actually, you're wrong. The rate of false rape claims is around 50%. On November 18, 2011, as a follow-up to their contretemps about the rate of false reporting, Chief Muir emailed Carrie Barrett an article titled "False Rape Allegations, An Assault on Justice" by Bruce Gross, published in 2009 in a periodical called The Forensic Examiner. The article's thesis, plainly stated in its title, was based largely on two academic studies, False Rape Allegations by Eugene J. Kanin, published in the 1994 edition of the Archives of Sexual Behavior, in which 45% of 173 reported rapes were determined to be untrue, and False Allegations by Charles P. McDowell, purportedly published in the 1985 edition of an obscure journal called the Forensic Science Digest, in which, according to Bruce Gross's interpretation of the data, 45% of 1,218 reported rapes were determined to be untrue. Scholars have debunked both of these articles. Kanin examined a single police department in a small Midwestern city and merely took police officers at their word when they classified a rape allegation as false. He made no effort to independently corroborate whether the allegations were actually false. Furthermore, the police department in question used a polygraph, or threatened to use a polygraph, to identify the false allegations, methods widely acknowledged as unreliable. As an International Association of Chiefs of Police policy manual explains, rape victims often feel confused and ashamed, and experience a great deal of self-blame because of something they did or did not do in relation to the sexual assault. These feelings may compromise the reliability of the results of polygraphs and voice stress analyzers. Some states have even enacted laws prohibiting the police from offering a polygraphic examination to sexual assault victims or from using the results to determine whether criminal charges will be filed. As David Lisak pointed out in a critique published in 2007, Kanin's 1994 article on false allegations is a provocative opinion piece, but it is not a scientific study of the issue of false reporting of rape. It certainly should never be used to assert a scientific foundation for the frequency of false allegations. It simply reflects the conclusions of police officers whose procedures have been rejected by the U.S. Department of Justice and by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Despite being discredited, the studies by Kanin and McDowell, named previously, are still routinely cited on numerous websites dedicated to advancing the notion that American society suffers from an epidemic of spurious rape allegations by malicious women, resulting in the wrongful conviction of many thousands of innocent men. Prominent among these websites is A Voice for Men, a men's rights movement blog that receives some 30,000 page views per day. As stated on the site, AVFM's mission is to denounce the institution of marriage as unsafe and unsuitable for modern men, educate men and boys about the threats they face in feminist governance, and push for an end to rape hysteria, among other goals. In June 2014, the U.S. News Director of AVFM, Robert O'Hara, told Al Jazeera America correspondent Nicole Grether, "We also want to challenge the media environment. It seems that our opponents, feminists, have a stranglehold on the media and the entire discourse about gender relations and gender issues." In O'Hara's opinion, the American news media, under the influence of a feminist cabal, have unfairly painted the men's rights movement as a bunch of crazy psychopaths who hate women and want to kill them, and they do this in order to basically silence us and keep us from getting our message across. Part of that message concerns what AVFM perceives to be an alarming upsurge in false rape allegations. It's one of our top issues, he says. We hear all these silly lies. There's a rapist behind every corner. All men are potential rapists. Common things you hear over and over again coming out of the mouths of feminists. And the inflated rape statistics, this idea that 1 in 4 women in college are going to be raped before they graduate, you hear this all the time. It's just not true. It's not true. I don't have the exact statistics with me right now, but you'll see it's usually around 2% of women in their lifetime will have some kind of problem with sexual assault. That's the same as having been mugged or having someone break into your house. This whole rape thing has been used by feminists to garner political power, lots of it, and money. The whole thing has been used as a scam. AVFM is often shrugged off as a fringe website that functions as a soapbox for wingnuts. But it's not just men who believe that sexual assault statistics have been wildly exaggerated to advance a political agenda. Some of the most prominent critics of rape hysteria have been female writers such as Katie Royfe, Christina Hoff Summers, Heather MacDonald, and Kathy Young. Other writers, such as Judith Shulevitz, Emily Yaffe, and Zoe Heller, take a more nuanced view, arguing that although campus rape is a serious problem, universities have overreacted to it, resulting in the denial of due process to men accused of rape. Without question, blameless men are sometimes falsely accused of rape, and sometimes expelled from college or sent to prison. When this occurs, the consequences for those who have been unfairly impugned can be ruinous. The Duke LaCrosse case is perhaps the most notorious example in recent years. In March 2006, a female stripper accused 3 members of the Duke University lacrosse team of sexually assaulting her after she'd been hired to entertain them at a raucous party. The 3 men were charged with rape by Durham County District Attorney Mike Nifong. But in December 2006, Nifong was cited by the North Carolina State Bar for violating rules of professional conduct, including making more than 100 false statements to the media. A month later, the North Carolina Bar filed additional, even more serious ethics charges against Nifong, this time for withholding exculpatory DNA evidence to mislead the court. And in April 2007, charges were dropped against all 3 lacrosse players, and they were declared innocent. Nifong, described as a rogue prosecutor, was disbarred for dishonesty, fraud, deceit, and misrepresentation shortly thereafter. The case of Brian Banks is in many ways even more unsettling. In 2002, Banks was a junior at Polytechnic High School in Long Beach, California, a 6'4", 225-pound linebacker on an extraordinary football team. One of his teammates was DeSean Jackson, who went on to be an all-pro wide receiver and return specialist for the Philadelphia Eagles in the National Football League. Banks was aggressively recruited by some of the nation's top college football programs and accepted a scholarship offer from the University of Southern California. Shortly thereafter, Brian Banks' life was upended. While attending summer classes before his senior year at Long Beach Poly, Banks had a chance encounter with a sophomore named Juanetta Gibson that, according to Banks, culminated in consensual sex. According to Gibson, Banks raped her. In a note Gibson wrote to a friend, which became a crucial piece of evidence, she said Banks picked me up and put me in the elevator, and he took me downstairs, and he pulled my pants down, and he raped me, and he didn't have a condom on, and I was a virgin, and now I'm not. When interviewed by the police, Juanetta Gibson told a more detailed version of the same story, and Brian Banks, who was 17 years old, was charged with forcible rape. Were he convicted, he could be sentenced to life in prison. Like thousands of other defendants ensnared in the criminal justice system, Brian Banks accepted a plea deal. To avoid going to trial and placing his fate in the hands of a jury, Banks agreed to plead no contest to the rape charge, spend at least 5 years in prison, remain on probation for an additional 5 years, and register as a sex offender. While Brian Banks was serving his time, Juanetta Gibson and her mother filed a lawsuit against the Long Beach Unified School District, claiming that lax security at Poly High School created an unsafe environment that led her to being raped. The suit was settled out of court, with the school district agreeing to pay Gibson $1.5 million. 9 months after Gibson says she was raped, however, her conscience began to bother her. In March 2011, a few years after Brian Banks was released from prison, he logged on to Facebook and saw he'd received a friend request from Juanetta Gibson, his accuser. Banks, who was unemployed and still trying to get his life in order, accepted the request and learned that Gibson wanted to let bygones be bygones. Banks asked if she would meet with him in the presence of a private investigator, Freddie Parrish, whose son had been a teammate of his at Poly. Gibson agreed, and during their meeting she admitted what Banks knew to be the truth all along. He had not raped her. Unbeknownst to Juanetta Gibson, Parrish was secretly recording the conversation. Armed with Gibson's confession, Banks set out to clear his name with the assistance of an attorney named Justin Brooks, who worked for the Innocence Project, a non-profit organization dedicated to exonerating the wrongly convicted. Less than a year after making the accusation, Gibson, it transpired, had confessed to a classmate that she'd concocted the rape story to prevent her mother from learning that she was sexually active. Brian Banks's conviction was reversed in May 2012. 13 months later, the Long Beach Unified School District won a $2.6 million default judgment against Juanetta Gibson to recoup the settlement she had received, plus interest and damages. So Banks was exonerated, but it can hardly be said that the outcome was just. His reputation was destroyed. He was denied the opportunity to attend college on a scholarship and play football for USC. Unlike his high school teammate DeSean Jackson, who became a nationally recognized celebrity, Brian Banks's shot at NFL stardom was stolen from him by Juanetta Gibson. After Brian Banks was absolved, he was signed by the Atlanta Falcons and played in the 2013 NFL preseason, but he was cut from the team before the first regular season game. It's not easy to make an NFL roster as a 28-year-old. After an 11-year hiatus from football, more than 5 years of which were spent behind bars, it's almost impossible. Nobody should be subjected to what Brian Banks was forced to endure. Police and prosecutors are morally and professionally obligated to make every effort to identify specious rape reports, safeguard the civil rights of rape suspects, and prevent the falsely accused from being convicted. At the same time, however, police and prosecutors are obligated to do everything in their power to identify individuals who have committed rape and ensure that the guilty are brought to justice. These two objectives are not mutually exclusive. A meticulous, expertly conducted investigation that begins by believing the victim is an essential part of prosecuting and ultimately convicting those who are guilty of rape. It also happens to be the best way to exonerate those who have been falsely accused. Rape victims provide police with more information and better information when detectives interview them from a position of trust rather than one of suspicion. Which is not to suggest that cops should simply accept the veracity of victims' stories without subsequently corroborating them. They need to trust but verify, as President Ronald Reagan famously described his approach to international diplomacy. The sad tale of Brian Banks notwithstanding, police and prosecutors generally do a pretty good job of weeding out false rape accusations to avoid charging the innocent. But cops and prosecutors are not nearly as conscientious when it comes to pursuing charges against those who are guilty. This is borne out by statistics indicating, indisputably, that the overwhelming majority of rapists get away scot-free. In a highly regarded paper published in 2010, False Allegations of Sexual Assault, an analysis of 10 years of reported cases, David Lisak and three co-authors found that the prevalence of false allegations is between 2 and 10%. That figure was based on 8 methodologically rigorous studies. In the concluding paragraphs of this report, Lisak noted, "These findings contradict the still widely promulgated stereotype that false rape allegations are a common occurrence. In the emotionally charged public discourse about sexual violence, it is often the case that assertions are made without reference to research data. Such assertions not only undermine rational discourse, but also damage individual victims of sexual violence. The stereotype that false rape allegations are a common occurrence, a widely held misconception in broad swaths of society, including among police officers, has very direct and concrete consequences. It contributes to the enormous problem of underreporting by victims of rape and sexual abuse. It is estimated that between 64% and 96% of victims do not report the crimes committed against them. And a major reason for this is the victim's belief that his or her report will be met with suspicion or outright disbelief. The stereotype also contributes to negative responses to victims who do report, whether by family members or by personnel within the criminal justice system. When law enforcement personnel believe that half or more of rape reports are fabricated, their approach to victims can easily become more akin to hostile interrogation than to fact-finding. Rape is the most underreported serious crime in the nation. Carefully conducted studies consistently indicate that at least 80% of rapes are never disclosed to law enforcement agencies. Analysis published in 2012 by Kimberly Lonsway, Director of Research at End Violence Against Women International, and Joanne Archambault, formerly a police sergeant in charge of the San Diego Sex Crimes Unit, suggests that only between 5% and 20% of forcible rapes in the United States are reported to the police. A paltry 0.4% to 5.4% of rapes are ever prosecuted, and just 0.2% to 2.8% of forcible rapes culminate in a conviction that includes any time in jail for the assailant. Here's another way to think about these numbers. When an individual is raped in this country, more than 90% of the time, the rapist gets away with the crime. Only 3 days after Carrie Barrett and Caitlin Kelly met with Missoula Chief of Police Mark Muir in November 2011, the University Court ruled that Kelly's assailant, Calvin Smith, was guilty of rape and expelled him. The action taken by the university was a disciplinary matter, however, not a legal proceeding. It had no impact on Chief Deputy County Attorney Kirsten Papp's contention that her office lacked sufficient evidence to establish probable cause for prosecuting Smith. The criminal case against him was not reopened, and details of the university's proceedings against him were sealed. Smith's expulsion for rape had serious repercussions. It made it all but impossible for him to attend any other public college or university in Montana. But he was not required to register as a sex offender, and the fact that the university court had found him guilty of rape did not appear anywhere in the public record. Smith returned home, enrolled in a nearby community college, and resumed posting banal comments on social media as if nothing had happened. On November 29th, 11 days after the university court hearing, he joked on his Facebook timeline about getting an erection from watching a Victoria's Secret fashion show. Kelly's life, on the other hand, was utterly transformed by the rape. "I stayed in school a little while after the university court hearing," she told me. "But I wasn't attending classes or doing anything. I just sat in my room, in bed, crying all the time." In early December, Kelly's mother convinced her to come home so her family could look after her. "At that point, I dropped out of school and haven't been back since," Kelly said. "The University of Montana is ruined for me. I did get counseling when I first got home, but I still cry all the time. It's something in my mind. I can't stand to talk about what happened or even think about it, because it makes me feel like shit. I've tried to forget, but..." She left the remainder of the sentence unstated. Barrett remained traumatized long after being assaulted, too. After completing her final exams in mid-December 2011, she flew home to New Jersey for the Christmas break. On December 21st, while surfing the internet, she happened to see reporter Gwen Florio's story in the Missoulian about Kelsey Belknap, who was allegedly gang-raped by members of the UM football team on December 15, 2010. "When I read that the Missoula County attorney refused to file charges because the football players claimed the sex was consensual," Barrett told me, "I began to wonder if maybe this was a pattern. I began to do some research into how often rape cases are prosecuted or not prosecuted in Missoula, and it made me really, really angry. So I decided to call Gwen Florio and tell her about my own experience with the police and prosecutors." Barrett also persuaded Caitlin Kelly to talk to Florio. Florio wrote an article about the two women that was published in the Missoulian on January 7th, 2012. A second, more detailed piece appeared on January 8th. Neither article revealed the women's names. In the latter article, Florio gave Kirsten Papps the opportunity to explain her decision not to prosecute Calvin Smith for raping Caitlin Kelly. We have so much reverence for the fact that when we file sex charges against someone, it's going to ruin their life, Pabst said. Filing charges rings a bell that cannot be unrung. When Missoula City Councilwoman Cynthia Woken read Floria's articles about the way the Missoula police handled Barrett's and Kelly's cases, she was concerned enough to request that Chief of Police Mark Muir appear in a videotaped forum held on January 25th, 2000.